Hey, y'all, I am relaunching the show on July 14th and could use some help that day. So if you're interested in being involved, shoot me an email at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and say, I'm in. All I'm asking is for a few seconds of your time. And if you can do this, I'll send you my one-page cheat sheet, how to nail the first 10 seconds of every patient encounter, and then enter you into a raffle to win some stuff that I'll mention in a second. So here's all I'm asking. To boost my visibility, I'm asking you to download 10 episodes on that day on July 14th, subscribe to the show, and leave a review. If you have an iPhone, it has to be on Apple Podcasts. If you don't have an iPhone, do it on Spotify. And when you leave that review, take a screenshot and shoot me an email with that screenshot, and that's when I'll enter you in the raffle. And so that's two emails. The first one to just let you know I'm in, and then I'll just shoot you a reminder that day with all the instructions on it. And again, download 10 episodes, subscribe to the show, leave a review, and then take a screenshot, send it to me, and I'll enter you in the raffle and then send you that cheat sheet on how to nail the first 10 seconds of every patient encounter. Okay, so the prizes. One prize will be a takeover of the show, which means I'll interview you, or you can interview me, or whoever you want. Topic to be approved. Okay, one winner. Two winners will get a set of Fig Scrubs, and then five winners will get a Succeed in Medicine, because that's my new name. It's not Physician's Guide to Doctoring anymore. Succeed in Medicine, a Yeti mug with the logo on it. Okay? So again, if you're interested in helping me out on July 14th, shoot me an email that says I'm in, brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com. And then on July 14th, you'll do those things. You'll shoot me a second email with a screenshot. I'll send you the one pager and enter you in the raffle. Thanks a lot for your help, guys. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Welcome back to the podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about religion and medicine. Have you ever struggled with how your own religion fits with the practice of medicine, or maybe how your patient's religion does? If you've ever grappled with that, this is the episode for you. So on today's episode, we're welcoming back Dr. Jonathan Winkle. Dr. Winkle is an internist and pediatrician who practices primary care and serves as the chief medical officer at the Squirrel Hill Health Center in Pittsburgh. He's a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine in the MedPeds residency program, and he serves as the clinical assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at also Pitt, and part-time instructor in Pitt's Department of Religious Studies and the Conceptual Foundation of Medicine Certification Program. And if you listen to our episode from a few years ago, when I had like three little toddlers running around the house, not the, the bigger kids that I have now, you can listen to the story of how he considered becoming a rabbi, right? But here's some more about him. So he teaches the undergraduate course, Death and the Healthcare Professions and Healing in Humanity. He's the author of the books, Healing People, Not Patients, Creating Authentic Relationships in Modern Healthcare, and From Illness to Exodus, creator of the website healerswholisten.com. And he posts blogs on the crossroads between healing and the Jewish tradition. And on today, we're going to be talking about that book, Illness to Exodus. So Dr. Winkle, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me back, Brad. It's really great to talk after all this time.
Jonathan, please start off by telling us a story, right? In the great Jewish tradition of storytelling, mm-hmm. I want you to tell us the story of what inspired you to write the book, Illness to Exodus.
Sure. So you mentioned my first book, Healing People, Not Patients. And I went through this whole arc of how do you take this one essential idea of people being created in God's image and operationalize it so you can actually do it, right? That's a really highfalutin idea, but you need to be able to do those things every day. And I came to the conclusion in the last chapter that what we need is rituals that kind of instill that behavior in us. And then I kind of stopped, right? I said, well, maybe we could do something like, I don't know, a Passover Seder to teach people, right? Because that's that's the most widely observed ritual in Jewish practice. You sit around for hours retelling a story. And the idea is to, as a result of that, get you to behave more compassionately towards people who are suffering, people who are in narrow, tight places, all of those sorts of things. And I just kind of left that idea sitting there, and that book was published. But 6 months later, I was cleaning up from an actual Passover Seder, putting away my books, my Haggadot, which are the book that, for those who aren't Jewish, the book that you use at the Seder table to tell the story out of, completely out of order, even though the word Seder means order. Nothing in the Seder happens in the order that it happened in historically. And I said,
oh. Kind of like when we get a history from a patient.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Never do they say it in chronological order, right?
You start with what happened 2 days ago, and then at some point later you hear about Fred that we were, you know, best friends with 15 years ago, and it all kind of comes back together in jumbled order. That's exactly one of the things that I thought of as I was thinking of this. And I said, you know, there are Passover Haggadot about communism and Passover Haggadot about the American Jewish experience in the 1800s, and ones that were illustrated with people wearing bird heads and all sorts of other topics. You know, last year I bought one that's called the Human Rights Haggadah. There's one about everything. I said, I have a Harry Potter Haggadah. Why can't there be one about sickness and healing and wellness and all of the things that people go through? Because, you know, the Hebrew word for Egypt, which is, of course, where the Israelites were enslaved 3,500 years ago, is Mitzrayim. It means a narrow place or even dire straits. And what's a narrower place than being seriously ill or chronically ill? So when you start from there, you think, there's all sorts of stuff I can learn from this about what somebody must be going through when they're sick and what maybe I could go through as I, you know, we're supposed to identify with the people that were enslaved and also empathize with them and figure out how to help them, right? So because we're supposed to be free when we're sitting at the Seder table, we're these, you know, Roman patricians all of a sudden, what can we do for somebody who's still in that narrow place? So it's a book for patients who are feeling that right now and books for the people that are trying to help them.
So you mentioned the healing Seder, mm-hmm. right? And that's one of the things from your book. I actually wasn't sure if we were going to have time to get sure. to it with the interview, but this is the perfect segue, mm-hmm. right? Because we're talking about this juxtaposition sure. of medicine, healing, and religion. So what is the healing Seder you were mm-hmm. just referring to?
Right. So the Seder is well-set progression of different individual rituals linked together with the story. And there's all sorts of kind of highlights through it. And what I did with my book is I structured it the way you would structure any book that you use at the Seder table. It's got the blessing over the wine at the beginning and a place where you dip parsley in salt water. And then a long stretch where you tell the story, totally out of order, like we said, with songs and examples and interpretations, and did a chapter for each piece. And in each chapter, just like we do at the Seder table, there's questions. I'll give you some examples of some of the ones that I put in. So, for example, there's a chapter about where does your story start, right? What's the beginning? Because, like I said, the Seder isn't getting told in order. So I ask a question like, where does your story start? If you're telling the narrative of your illness, what's chapter one? Is it the day you got diagnosed? Or are you far enough in that you're already thinking about 6 months earlier where you first had that nagging symptom that you didn't do anything about, that you ignored, that you tried to explain away? Or maybe you're somebody who's suffering from psychological trauma because you were in an abusive relationship and your story starts when that relationship started. So that's one example of what we do. Or taking the rituals. You know, I mentioned the prayer over the wine, the Kiddush at the beginning. It's how we start every holiday in Judaism. You raise a glass of wine, and my Australian rabbi friend, Danny Schiff, talks about separate in order to elevate. If I can mimic him on a podcast, which I do all the time, and he's very resilient about that sort of thing. And that's exactly what you're taking this, you know, wine that you poured out of a bottle, but you're separating it out and saying, this is important. And then you say, and here's all the reasons it's important. It's important because this is special, and because this is special, and because this is special. So looking at it from the healer side, if I'm a doctor and I'm going to work every day and I'm clicking away on my keyboard in an EHR that I don't like, and I'm fighting with insurance companies, and I'm having people yell at me because they didn't get their prescriptions filled, or because they're waiting on test results that I haven't been able to give them, or because they can't get through to my office. It's not just my office. Every doctor's office is really hard to get through to on the phone. I know because I was on the other end of it. It's just impossible to get through to doctors as a profession on the phone. And how do I take that drudgery and make it special? And so I'm actually right now, as we're talking, you know, sometime in the next couple of days, I'm probably going to post a kiddush for doctors, like a prayer that you can say when your day starts. I wouldn't recommend saying it over wine at 8:30 in the morning. That might get you brought up in front of the state medical board. But saying it over your morning cup of coffee, there's also something in there about saying a prayer over your second cup of coffee, just so that we're clear.
In case you need it.
Right, yeah, in case you need it.
Well, that was reserved right, for special occasions.
But that you can say to take that drudgery and raise it from the level of something mundane to something holy. And by the way, the coffee is where I talk about how we are not so different from our patients dealing with addictive disorders because of how so many of us depend on stimulants to keep us functioning.
Absolutely. And then we justify it with literature, right?
Right?
I'm not sure how many of those studies about how healthy coffee is, mm-hmm. is just like selection bias by physicians trying to find something to justify
for sure.
our own habits and addiction. Mm-hmm. What is it? Intermittent fasting mm-hmm. is just, you know, people who skip breakfast anyway are trying to find justification for the fact
right.
that they skip breakfast.
Exactly. So
what you're getting to is rituals,
mm-hmm.
right? And actually, I've heard the kiddush before you start your day. I've heard of that in people who, you know, these like people who try to have the perfect day. Mm-hmm. How's your day going to start? You have these rituals. You do it the same day. Mm-hmm. So you make sure your day goes right. And one of those things is a meditation at the beginning of the day. And it's a short meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You close your eyes and you say to yourself, today is going to be a good day. Like, and you don't, instead of, you know, doing what I do, which is you sit in your car and scroll on social media until you got to get, you know, mm-hmm. get your butt out of there and into the office to start your day. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, right.
Right.
I gotta, it's a full day of patience. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to fall behind. I know I'm going to get yelled at. I know I'm going to be stressed out. Right. Instead of doing that, what we should be doing is taking a deep breath and telling ourselves that today is going to be a good day mm-hmm. and starting it on the right foot. And a great way to do that is with a kiddush. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Kind of. Except for the part
kinda.
Where you said...
Okay, that's how it's
yeah, ended up. Yes, but except for the part where you said today is going to be a great day. Because one of the things I talk about is we can't promise that it's going to be a great day. It might be an insane day. It might be a terrible day.
No, but to start off right. in a positive yes. way, instead of like, oh... another day, right? Which is how a lot of people start their day. I would argue most
saying,
people probably
what
start
I'm
their
doing
day.
Today matters. What I'm doing today is super
yeah.
important. It's important to me because it's my identity and it's important to the people that I'm going to work with, even if it turns out to be terrible. Right. So we're not going in with puppies and rainbows view of the world, but we're going
no.
in with a sense of purpose and a sense of determination. And I know from bad stretches in my life, and I'm sure based on what you just described that you've had those too, and all of our colleagues have, where that sense of purpose
yeah.
just disappears. And this is a way to get it back every day, even if you can't promise, like, I'm going to knock it out of the park today, I'm going to matter. I'm going to matter today, regardless of how things go.
And that's actually, I just did another interview with someone else where we discussed Viktor Frankl, and
mm-hmm.
it sounds like he's coming up again.
Yes.
Right? He argued against Freud. Freud said that people were in pursuit of pleasure,
mm-hmm.
and Frankl said that people were in pursuit of purpose and meaning. So what you're saying is today is
mm-hmm.
going to be a day filled with purpose and meaning. Is it going to be a good day?
Mm-hmm.
No. Is it going to be a bad?
Exactly
I don't know.
Right.
But it's going to be filled with, I'm going to help a bunch of people. It's going to be filled with purpose and meaning.
Yep. He's in,
in
chapter 25.
So there are already rituals in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have these rituals, right? Our hand washing, like, you know,
bingo.
Even for the non-surgeons, when you go into the operating room, at least when you were a resident or a medical student and you do your mm-hmm. hand washing, right? And we have these graduation ceremonies, like we have these rituals
mm-hmm.
already in medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that came up as I was working on this, I got to have a conversation with my friend Alicia Waldman, who is also a physician author who I don't know if you've come across him. He's a pediatric oncologist and palliative care doc. And we talked a lot about washing because in his book, which actually happens to be called The Narrow Space, his title kind of inspired me to think about this as well. He talks about being called in to help wash a body after one of his patients passed, which is a traditional Jewish ritual that's done after death before wrapping the body for burial. It's also traditional in Muslim burial, by the way, almost exactly the same way. And we sort of spiraled from that into talking about the the way in which medicine had been ritualized to the point of kind of being a religion unto itself. So it's they definitely exist. I think that even with those, though, sometimes people don't have the purposefulness that really makes a ritual meaningful. The ritual becomes part of the drudgery, which it does for religious people, too. Absolutely. People go through the motions and don't think about what they're doing. So sometimes it's helpful to have words and sort of a pre-ritual to get yourself in the mindset, which I think is really important.
Yeah. I mean, you can turn it, you can take something that's mundane and routine and turn it into a ritual that reminds you of the meaning behind it. It sounds like that's what you're getting at.
Exactly.
Like, and it sounds like this is even, you know, we talk about burnout all the time. Mm-hmm. Everyone's talking about burnout. And whether you're burned out or not, if these things can make your life better and give your life meaning, I'm all for it. And it sounds like, you know, a lot of us are in these positions where we forget about the sacredness of what we do and the meaning and the purpose. Because for us, it does become mundane, right? You see the same pathologies over and over. And you see the same, have the same conversations over and over. And a lot of times it can stop lacking the intellectual stimulation that it once did because it's so repetitive. And then you forget that the person in front of you, what my wife says is, you know, when you're on Broadway, you do these shows 7 or 8 times a week. And it's the same show every time. But for the audience, it's the first time they've seen it. And it's the same thing with your patients. Right. Like, you're doing this all the time, but for the patient, it's the first time. And it sounds like a lot of what you're saying is it's a way to reframe these things so that you are treating it like the Broadway show that it should
be. Exactly. You know, it's interesting. One of the things you said about sort of regaining interest, like, you've seen this happen when you have a patient who's got a particularly interesting medical situation going on where there's intellectual challenge to it that maybe, you know, in primary care, I've seen in the course of a week, 10 people with muscular low back pain, and I've seen 5 kids with strep throat, and I've seen the vast majority of my patients who I'm managing chronic diabetes, hypertension, COPD. Those situations are really important, and I definitely need that ritual to keep me focused and caring as deeply as I should. And then you get the person who's like, I think this person might have lupus. Lupus gets everybody's motor running in internal medicine because it's fascinating. It can look like all sorts of different things, and there's all sorts of tests you got to do. And you get into these discussions with your partners about, like, well, you know, this person looked like they had peripheral neuropathy from a vitamin deficiency, but then I've looked at their toes and they've got classic Raynaud's phenomenon. What are we doing now? And it just, there's this intellectual curiosity. One of the things about the Seder is you take these words that you read the same words every year, or if you're conservative Orthodox, 2 times every year, and you could just do what, you know, my wife's grandfather and great uncle used to do, and, you know, speed through the whole thing in very heavily Russian accented Hebrew and not let anybody else speak. Or in my grandfather's case, speed through it a little bit slower in very stilted English from the old Reform Haggadah. Or you can talk about it and ask questions and debate and argue, and it can stretch on. You know, there's a story in the Haggadah about these rabbis that end up staying up all night debating this, so that somebody has to come knock on the door and say, hey guys, the sun's up. And we can geek out, we can nerd out on medicine that way. But it only happens once in a while. So having some way of kind of recapturing the fascination. And actually, one of the ways that I do that in practice is the stories, right? I may have 5 patients out of my 8 for a half day who have diabetes. But when I'm huddling with my medical assistant, my med student in the morning, I go in and I say, okay, so this guy moved here from Syria 15 years ago, or 14 years ago, that's when the war started. And used to own an ice cream shop. And I'll talk about how fascinated he is with ice cream. And, you know, he'll say, someday and everything's peaceful, you'll come to Damascus and have some of my ice cream. Right? That story helps me recapture it, even if there's not anything particularly medically fascinating going on.
You spent years learning how to save lives, but no one taught you how to secure your own. When you work one-on-one with a CFP professional financial coach, you get a blueprint tailored for the long game of your complex situation. At My Financial Coach, they help physicians choose the best strategy to optimize your annuities and investments, implement tax-saving strategies, and tackle debt like your student loans or mortgage while refining your path to retirement. Save up for that boat, a child's college or wedding, or even a vacation home. Plan ahead for the impacts of the unexpected and understand how much life insurance you actually need. Project how getting married, raising children, or taking care of an aging parent affects the progress towards your goals. Advice-only financial planning through a fixed monthly subscription, not commissions, to keep planning unbiased and in your best interest. A financial plan isn't just about your money, it's about your future. Visit myfinancialcoach.com/physician's guide to doctoring to meet with a financial coach and find out if concierge financial planning is right for you. Again, myfinancialcoach.com/physician's guide to doctoring.
It's the people. Mm-hmm. It's the connections. Yep. It's the social connections, right? This keeps on coming up over and over. You know, the best measure, the best predictor of health and longevity is the strength of your social connections. Mm-hmm. And we can be leveraging that to be making our lives better, right?
Oh,
like take an interest in your patients. I mean, that's your whole thing, right? Like treat it, healing people, not patients.
Exactly.
And so, you know, clearly I'm preaching to the choir here. No religious reference intended there.
Oh, thank you. Let it go.
Yes,
I will say that's probably also why the Seder is the most widely observed ritual, because you do it sitting around a table talking to people. You're not sitting in a pew facing forward, you know, trying to be quiet when you're not supposed to talk or talking.
And you mentioned, I think it was your father-in-law that that blew through it in the Russian accent. Was that
my wife's grandfather? Yeah,
blew through the Seder. Mm-hmm. So my wife, who was not, her mother's Jewish, mm-hmm. her father's devout Christian. Mm-hmm. She was raised more Christian than Jewish. She didn't really know much mm-hmm. about Judaism growing up. Then she married me. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Long Island Jewish family.
Right.
And she attended her first Seder at my house. And she was going to be the youngest there. It was before there were any like grandkids or grandkids that could talk. So she learned the four questions and she spent all this time like memorizing them and got it right and did and nailed it. But then through the whole Seder, my mom blew through the Seder like that. Mm-hmm. She went through it to go through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was like really distraught by this. She's like, what did I spend all this time working on this for, only for you guys to like blow through the Seder? What's going mm-hmm. on here? So that ended up becoming one of my families, you know, my wife and my kids, one of the most important parts of our family, like our,
that's great.
One of the pillars that we always go back to, which is it needs to have meaning. Everything needs to have meaning. Never do something because this is the way it's always been done. Everything needs a why. And that why might change over time. Why are we in this sport? Why are my kids doing this on the weekend? Why are we, you know, why do we do this? And it all needs to come. It needs to have a legitimate why. Mm-hmm. And so the Seder, you know, we came back to, well, why do we even have the Seder? Mm-hmm. And so now we conduct the Seder in such a way that is the kids telling us the mm-hmm. story and us filling in the gaps. Like that's the purpose of telling the story. That has nothing to do with what we were talking about, but I just want to, you know, a little color, add a little color about my family.
I love it. And there's a couple of things that made me think of, you know, one is, and I tell this story in the book, the year my youngest son was either in kindergarten or first grade, he gets up, you know, he's done the four questions and we're a little bit past that point in the Seder. So we're like 20 minutes into what in my house is usually between a 60 and 90 minute storytelling phase. And he says, Abba, I have a question. And I say, okay, Adi, what's the question? And he starts talking. And I realize very quickly, he's not asking. It's like a guy standing up at a conference and saying, that was a wonderful presentation. I just have one question. And then there's no question there. He's pontificating. But in this case, he starts telling his understanding of all of the things he's learned about the Passover story, from Abraham smashing the idols all the way through crossing the Red Sea into the desert. And it takes him like 15 minutes and we stop and everybody's like, that was amazing. And my mother turns to me and she says, now can we eat? And I was like, normally I'm like, stop nudging me. But this time I was like, yeah, we can eat. He finished. He said everything. He caught all of the major points. He got the plagues, he got the shank bone, he got everything. So, and it reminds me of some of the research that I kind of alluded to in the first book and that I teach about when I'm in some of these courses, which is, you know, doctors, we interrupt people very fast when they start talking to us. There's a variety of studies on it, but the shortest interval that I've seen is 6 seconds. And the longest interval that I've seen is 23 before the first interruption on average. It actually only takes most people 2 minutes to tell you the entirety of the story of why they're there. And maybe they've got more to tell you, but I mean, even a very talkative 6-year-old couldn't go on for more than 15 minutes. So a tired 50-year-old is certainly not going to go on for more than 5. We can let people talk, and I can tell you that is the story.
Because I was using one of our previous sponsored Freed AI as one of those AI scribes. So it's on my phone and I'm using it and it has a timer on it. So it will tell me how long the person's been talking for. And in my anecdotal experience, it's around 2 minutes. Yeah, it's about 2 minutes for most patients. Some go on to 4, some go on to 5, but like it's really not that long. And then one of the advantages of the AI scribe is you can actually start examining them as they're continuing to tell the story because it'll document. So when you have someone who's gone on particularly long time, you can still let them talk because then you're getting your exam as well. But so actually I want to segue to a little different topic because we're running out of time.
No,
they're not sponsoring us right now. They're not, but hopefully soon. You know, the juxtaposition of religion and medicine, they kind of seem at odds, right? Because there's religion and tradition, and then there's science. And so, you know, sometimes it finds its way in our exam room in that, you know, someone's religious beliefs might conflict with medical advice. Mm-hmm. And so what do you recommend we do in a situation like
that? Right. So first of all, that I think some of the conflict is imagined, right? When we think about the conflict, the first thing that comes to mind is these hot button political issues like abortion, like end of life care, and particularly physician assisted suicide. And those are very, very fiery debates, but they're a tiny fraction of what we do in medicine. So that's the first point I want to make. The other thing that we have in mind is this idea of, you know, Galileo being thrown in the dungeon and religion being anti-science. The greatest religious mind in Jewish tradition was also the greatest physician in Jewish tradition and a great astronomer and philosopher and scientist of all sorts of, you know, natural sciences that I don't even remember what he did, which was Moses Maimonides. There was no distinction in the Middle Ages and the Muslim countries between doing science and being a person of faith. He was a complete rationalist. My whole point of talking about this is not only is it important to have ritual and to rededicate ourselves to what matters to us, but if you dig deep into your religious tradition, or not even that deep, that's where the principles, at least for me, of why I'm doing this in the first place come from, that life is sacred, that people who are at a disadvantage deserve our attention, deserve to be noticed, and deserve for us to take care of them. I heard a really great presentation from Rabbi Shai Held, who has been labeled as, you know, one of the greatest X number of Jews living in the country today, one of the great religious figures in the country today. But one of the things that he talked about is that, you know, at least our view of humanity isn't that we're like, you know, all good and that we, you know, have this amazing potential, whatever. It's that we're better than we give ourselves credit for being. And the commandments to do things like clothe somebody who's naked, or feed somebody who's hungry, or be kind to the stranger, which appears 36 times in the Torah. Those are challenges. Those are like, you could do better at this than you think you can. You could try harder. You could achieve something more. You may not be perfect. In fact, I know you're not perfect and you're going to screw up and you're going to have to atone for it next Yom Kippur, different book. But you are better than you think you are. And I think we as medical providers can be better than that. So what do I do for somebody where there's a religious conflict? Same thing that I told you I would do with the last book, which is explore what their reasons are.
Yeah.
One of the things that I learned in the course of writing the first book was not to scream at people, you know, and this is weird to say right now, not to scream at people who said, my religion says I shouldn't vaccinate my kids, right? I am 110% pro-vaccine. I've done a lot of work in my time to make sure the kids are vaccinated. We are right now working on a campaign to reach out to every kid in our, to the family of every kid in our practice who doesn't look like they have a full set of MMR shots and make sure they get them so that the next measles outbreak isn't in my practice. But there is something that I didn't mention in the book, but there's a point in Genesis where, you know, the whole, you know, not being able to have a baby thing. And God says to Abraham, go listen to your wife, you know, listen to her, do see what she has to say. And I mean, that's what I feel like I'm being told to do. Go listen to this person and see what they have to say. Yeah. And then we can come to some agreement, because there's so many things I can do, especially as a primary care doctor. Like, somebody may be coming to see you and like, are you going to put tubes in my kid's ear or are you not going to put tubes in? Like, you have one decision to make. And I'm glad you're making the decision, because you have much better skills with your hands than I do. But for us, it's every decision, including like, where do I go to learn how to drive? Right. I mean, I'm seeing people who are brand new to the country who don't know how the country works, let alone how medicine works. And we have this certain halo around this. They ask us all sorts of questions. Just listen to what they need. There's usually something I can do for somebody, even if they don't want everything I can do for them.
So my last question was going to be a piece of advice for people struggling with the tension between science and faith. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like your answer is lean into it, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Not lean away from it, but lean into it, because, you know, except in very special circumstances, mm-hmm. except in those rare circumstances that you mentioned earlier, right? Mm-hmm. That it sounds like your faith is going to give you, you know, you're going to use your faith to help guide you, to mm-hmm. help continue to give you purpose and meaning and understanding and connection, right? Because we mm-hmm. all have, even if we're from different religions, we all have so much, we're all so much more alike than we are different.
Yeah.
So am I correct in saying that that's your answer if someone's struggling with the
leaning into the tension? Leaning into the tension if we're not seeing eye to eye with each other, for sure, because there is plenty of instruction about how do we make peace with one another. There's something that I do quote in here, that there's a really interesting passage after the dinner part of the Seder where you open the door and you ask God to pour out God's wrath on those who don't know God. And a lot of people have a really hard time with that, because like, that sounds really angry and destructive. I'm not sure I can buy into that. And so the discussion I get into, I lost friends in the Tree of Life shooting. I have friends who were survivors of that shooting. And I had a chance to have a conversation with one of them about 3 years later. He actually wrote a poem, a reading that I've included in the book. And one of the things that he said is that the anger that he felt sort of permeating the community in the aftermath, he realized was quite destructive. And I think the lesson of that passage is actually human anger in general is really destructive. We should be looking for ways to make peace, you know. And in that chapter, I make mention of, you know, there's this... right after the Exodus is over, right after you get out of the Red Sea, you go into the desert, you get the Torah. And what's the first set of commandments? Don't wrong the stranger. And if your enemy's donkey collapses under its burden, you should go lift up the donkey and the burden with him. Right? So you're supposed to go to this guy who you hate, who just had a major calamity, right? Poor pack animal fell down. The animal never did anything to you. You're supposed to go help that person through it. And it's a really powerful message about people that we may not feel particularly drawn to, people that we have to take care of, that we genuinely bristle at being anywhere near them, that with a few limitations, there is a point where you should become angry. Maimonides famously said, those who don't become angry in situations where they should are like the dead. They're like, you know, like they're not even alive anymore because they should be angry about some things. But for the most part, you leave the anger for someone else and you figure out how to make peace. you know, I imagine like this Egyptian who was drowning in the Red Sea, like somehow making it out. And he's wandering around the desert with a donkey going, how the hell do I get back to Egypt? And somebody finds him just as his donkey has collapsed. And like, that guy tried to drown you. Doesn't matter. Go help him up. The last piece of that I'll mention is, so I'm talking about this in synagogue about a year ago. And an older guy, also a physician, an endocrinologist, comes up to me and says, you know, I really love Passover also, and I have a whole collection of Haggadahs. I'm going to send you a picture. And in my email later that week, I get this PDF of a picture from a Haggadah from Venice in 1609. And if you remember, in Venice in 1609, the Jews were being constrained to live in a ghetto, like the original ghetto. That's why it's spelled with a G-H, because yeah, it was created in Italy. And this book that was written in that setting has a woodcut illustration of the Red Sea has closed. There's Egyptians flailing around in the water, having been thrown off their horses, and Israelites on the other side reaching into the water to pull them out. Right? So doesn't matter what's happened between us. Somehow or other, there is commonality. And when it gets really ugly and nasty, it helps to like step out of the room, gather yourself, and remember, like, almost everybody, we can find that common ground. There are exceptions. I have certainly had one or two people in my career that I just have not been able to find that with. You know, I feel a little weak because of that. But for the most part, there's something that we can do.
Well, I'm sure Yoda had a couple of people he didn't get along with either. So,
Yoda.
Right? Like you can aspire. Right? Because you got to think, right? Like you can preach this type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps to have some fallibility in there too when you're doing, right? Like we're all works in progress, right? We should all be working to do better.
Right.
I certainly have a lot more than two of people that come to mind immediately.
Yep.
But to your point, like we should all be trying to do better. And, you know, something that I preach to my kids all the time, and they love making fun of me for it, is, you know, the hard thing to do is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And in situations like that, that's what it sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. Being kind to someone who is mean to you, being, kind to someone who is oppressing you, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is so hard. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, for physicians, you know, we have to remember that, like, we are almost never punching up in clinic. We may be punching up when we sit in the back room and talk about the CEO of the hospital or the person on the other end of the line at the insurance company, or, you know, whoever we feel is pressing down on us. When we're with our patients, we don't get to punch up. Like we're holding a lot of the cards, you know, they're the ones that are drowning.
Yes. 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 We have the leverage. We have the leverage to be able to pull them up. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, again, the book, the original book that we talked about, and I think at this point it was 4 years ago. It was like, I think just as the pandemic was starting,
January
5 years ago. Wow. Mm-hmm. And, that book, Healers Who Listen. And then this book, Illness to Exodus, and they can get it at your website, right?
So
on your website, healerswholisten.com.
So it is available on that website where people buy books. It's also available from my publisher, Whip and Stock. I'll give you the address to put in the show notes. If you go to the publisher, there is a discount code that can get people 40% off the cover price. So we'll put both of those into the show notes. I highly recommend working with them because they're a fantastic publisher. They were really nice to me.
Instead of giving more money to the billionaires.
Exactly. These are good people.
Awesome.
They're in Oregon. They're nice and crunchy.
Well, Jonathan Winkle, thanks for all you do for your patients and helping us to be better physicians.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice.
Thanks again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.